Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I will be with you for the next hour on this March the 26th on the West Coast, now March the 27th, Friday morning on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zones, and of course points east of there, all the way around the planet. Some weeks ago, actually, it was shortly after the plane crash in Buffalo, New York, which occurred on February 12th, I was introduced to two gentlemen who have been researching plane crashes and the mysterious deaths of great numbers of individuals, and they stumbled upon a model, a research model, that indicates very deep corruption in what is called a Tontine scam or a Tontine insurance scam. And we're going to be talking with tonight's guest, and I hope to say guests, adding an S to that as the show progresses. One of our guests is in another part of the world right now on a special mission, and we are hoping he checks in with us sometime during tonight's broadcast. Who am I referring to? Two gentlemen who have been writing and documenting the evidence, which is overwhelmingly pointing to three schemes that are interwoven together as a method for perpetrating these horrible acts against humanity for financial gain. And those individuals are David Hawkins and Field McConnell. With us right now, we have David Hawkins. Welcome again, David, to Evident Footprints.
Good evening.
Okay, I'm having a little bit of difficulty with the audio here. I think it's just our technical communications technology, we'll say, that's causing that. I think you said good evening. So
yes. Can you hear me?
Hello? Yes, I'm. Yeah, I'm getting a bit of a sort of a log jam of information here, but I'm sure it's nothing you're doing. You were coming through clearly before we went live, and all of a sudden it's stuttering a little bit, but we'll try to work through it. It may clear. I presume you said you're doing fine.
Yeah. Want me to call back, or do you want to call again, or?
Well, let's see if I can get Seth to communicate with me here, our engineer. I'm going to send him a short message here and see if we can clear this up. Seth, we're getting some delay on the communication line. David's line is coming through sort of log jammed, and there's a great amount of latency in the signal. You may want to reestablish communication with him, see if that clears up the problem, and I'll just keep talking through that. We got an okay, David, so you'll be disappearing for a moment and coming back.
So should I?
Okay, so we're taking care of that issue. Just a brief message about tomorrow night's show. Our resident scientist, inventor, lecturer, teacher, and author, Jim Murray, will again be visiting us here on Evident Footprints. And we'll be following through on a discussion that we've been having over the past few weeks. We've been talking about power. Technological power, and you may hear the dial tone.
Please leave a short message. I'll get back to you as soon as possible.
Okay. We got an answering machine. So that's not David, Seth. We've got a recording. And Seth's going to try again. anyway, Jim and I have been talking about power and new types of technology to produce some new power devices, new inventions, in other words. And in the process of that, we've been talking about the power that is generated for the purpose of controlling people, for controlling the masses, and the quest for power of all types. And so we've touched upon different aspects of that word power, and we're going to make a concerted effort tomorrow evening to redirect that topic back to the technology end, having prefaced it, I feel, and Jim feels, sufficiently with quite a bit of information on how that word is misused. It's misused by the media. It's misused by science. It's been a sticking point in a lot of ways, because our consciousness and our understanding of power versus energy are two different things.
Hello, okay, this is David.
Okay, sounds like we have you back, David. Welcome back to the show.
Okay, Don, is that better?
Much better, yes. Okay. Much better. We seem to have lost that that delay there, so that's great.
Okay.
When we had you on the show, I guess I could start over. How are you this evening?
Yes, no, I'm very well. I'm glad to be with you.
I'm glad to get a straight answer. That technology can be a curse or a blessing, you know, depending on what time of day or night you use it, I guess. The last time you were on the show, of course, we talked in depth about these Tontine scams that I alluded to in my introduction. And for the sake of any new listeners, I'm sure you've had to do this 1,000 times already. I'm going to ask you one more time, just to give us a brief summation. You are the expert in this area, and I can do it sort of colloquially. I understand the concept and who the players are, but if you could give the folks in the listening audience a picture of what this is and how it works and how it's being implemented.
Okay, certainly, Don. So it was invented back in the 17th century by a Lorenzo di Tonti, who became an advisor to the court of Louis the 14th, the Sun King. And the idea was, if the king wanted to finance a military expedition but didn't have the money in the treasury, he would invite a group of possibly noblemen or whatever to pop some money in what would become an annuity, and they would finance the trip essentially with a bond given them by the French government that would pay them back at a later date with an annuity. But all the profits, whatever the investment was made, were retained in the Tontine, as it was called, named after de Tonti, the inventor of the idea. The big problem, and it was reintroduced or reinvented, if you will, in the United States in 1868 by a very interesting pair of businesses. One was a company that would become the world's largest life insurance company, Equitable Life Insurance of the United States, in a partnership with a law firm that would perhaps become the most powerful law firm in the world, a law firm by the name of Sidley Austin in Chicago. And this practice actually, from 1868 to 1906, turned Equitable into the largest life insurance company in the world. However, in 1906, Don, it was banned in the United States because, as you can see, there's a moral hazard. The members of the Tontine, in order to scoop the pot, because everything goes to the last survivor, they have to kill each other. All right, so there's a moral hazard that you've got actually an annuity and a pension scheme, if you will, or an insurance scheme, where everyone has a vested interest in killing each other.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so it was banned in the United States. It wasn't, however, banned abroad. So what Equitable Life and Sidley Austin did is they found some partner banks outside the United States, in particular in Canada, the Royal Bank of Canada, the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank in London, and a French bank that would become known as BNP Paribas. And those three banks, from 1906 to the present day, we believe, have been heavily involved with Equitable Life and Sidley Austin in bringing Tontines back from outside the United States to kill American citizens. And
yes,
the idea here is, sorry?
I was just going to insert into that that that's documented, that sort of corruption in the financial arena.
Totally.
Is documented in other ways, too. So, yes.
That's right.
I support that.
So they just had to be smart. And essentially, I would say what happened in 1906 when it was banned in the United States was very similar to what happened in 1970 when the Racketeering Influence and Corrupt Organization Statute was introduced, to prevent a particular technique known as murder for hire, which is anyone who uses or travels interstate or foreign commerce or induces the victim to use or travel on interstate foreign commerce for the purposes of murdering someone for pecuniary compensation commits or violates this act, which means if you hire someone to kill someone across interstate lines or foreign... you are just as guilty as the shooter.
Mm-hmm. And what? This scheme that you're describing was promoted in the James Bond movies throughout the 60s.
Absolutely. So it's 140 years old. And what's totally fascinating is it would appear the Weatherman terrorist underground movement that was spawned in the 60s from the Students for a Democratic Society. In the 70s, when they were executing their bombings, led by a woman called Bernadine Dorn and her boyfriend, Bill Ayers, it looks now, from our research, that they were working with Sidley Austin, the law firm, to use this Tontine death squad, if you will, technique, where the targets would be entrapped into joining the Tontine, and ultimately face this moral hazard that in order to survive, they had to kill each other.
Mm-hmm.
And what's intriguing, and I'll fast forward to it, is it appears that Sidley Austin was either frightened or corrupted into recruiting a woman described as the most dangerous woman in America, the leader of the Weatherman terrorist underground movement, who worked for Sidley Austin in 1984 to 1988. Now, in 1984, it turns out that the Bhopal pesticide plant run by Union Carbide in India blew up and killed probably about 8,000 people. And everyone, particularly the media, went after the directors of Union Carbide. But it turns out it was sabotage.
Mm-hmm.
They actually connected a pipe of water. They pumped water into the chemical. It reacted and produced a pressure. The disabling system and safety valves had all been switched off. It blew up, and it created this cloud of poisonous gas. It caused tremendous havoc. But there were a number of people wandering around in Pakistan and India in the early 80s. One of them was a guy by the name of Barry Sweatero, whose name is now Barack Hussein Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And the man who was appointed to as a trustee of the Bhopal Hospital to treat these people and with the Indian government waive any other liabilities to Union Carbide was a man by the name of Sir Ian Percival, a Brit, who is the sole trustee of the hospital allegedly built for $500 million in Bhopal to treat the victims, and he was a partner in Sidley Austin.
Yes, now we have a number of issues that spring up from the timeline that you're describing. Number one, Obama, Satoru, whatever name you want to call him, we could call him the man in the moon, I suppose, based on the documentation he's provided the American people, in terms of a certificate of live birth or adoption papers from Indonesia that contain forged signatures or the bogus documents in Kenya. And I'm going to say they're bogus because the photographs supposedly supporting that documentation is also phony. You're describing a timeline, David, when Obama would have been finishing up his schooling at Occidental College in Los Angeles, or he would have just arrived at Columbia University. And there are numerous accounts. Some journalists have gone down this trail and ferreted out several Pakistanis at Occidental. So what you're describing now indicates that he was not at Occidental, but he would have been in Pakistan.
Yeah, he was actually setting up, I think, with his mother, who stayed at a five-star hotel in Lahore in Pakistan for 5 years, and she was a communist. And she and, we think, her son, Barry Sotero, were setting up communist cells in Pakistan and in India as part of this global revolutionary effort that had been triggered in the late 60s by Bernardine Dorn, the leader of the Students for a Democratic Society, and later the Weatherman's Underground Movement. What's absolutely fascinating is, in 1981, he was hunting about 200 miles south of Quetta, on the east coast, the west coast of Pakistan, in the area where a man called Osama bin Laden was collecting weapons to kick the Soviets out of Afghanistan. So we think that they may very well have met. But coming back, what's totally fascinating is the Tontine formula, if you will. What we think we understand now is that if these communists, Sotero and Bernardine Dorn and Bill Ayers and so on, decided they want to take out Union Carbide, what they were doing is they were selling through Sidney Austin what is known as D&O liability insurance. So D&O stands for directors and officers. Mm-hmm. And directors and officers liability insurance, it's really a version of the Tontine when you think about it, because what they're saying is, if the directors and officers of Union Carbide face a situation where one of their plants, like a pesticide plant, blows up and kills lots of people, they're going to have their backside sued off, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So to meet those costs, what Sidley Austin with the Equitable Life will do is they sell them directors and officers liability insurance, which picks up the costs of defending these people against a civil or a criminal lawsuit, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the same time, they hedge that risk, because obviously that would be very expensive, by buying insurance for the company if such an event should happen.
Yes.
I don't know if I'm explaining that very well, but what I'm saying is you can sell the directors and officers' liability insurance, which covers the cost of defending them, at the same time, because you have an insured interest, you buy insurance against the event happening.
Yes, yes. That makes total sense, and that's confirmed by what Walter Burian told me on the 17th of this month. Walter has an organization called CAFR One, and basically he's been investigating the comprehensive annual financial report.
That's right.
And
and
he's alluded to the fact that most of the soldiers in the military have policies, insurance policies, ranging from $5,000 to $35,000 each on themselves and possibly members of their family. But secretly, the Pentagon holds million-dollar policies on each of these soldiers.
Right, except that I would argue it's not the Pentagon, it's Sidley Austin. But just backing up here, which is fascinating. So we've got Bernardine Dorn, who joined Sidley Austin, recognized as the most dangerous woman in America, who managed to stay out of jail on the grounds of alleged prosecutorial misconduct. Now, back in the 70s, I don't know if you've heard of a software package called Promise,
mm-hmm.
which is the prosecutor's management information system.
That's
it
from
Inslaw's
Bill Hamilton actually heads that company.
Now, I think, and I do hope that Phil McConnell can join us, I think there was a woman planted inside the bureaucracy to get hold of a copy of Promise and convert it to the use of corrupt insiders at the Department of Justice,
mm-hmm.
such that these terrorists, like Bernardine Dorn and Bill Ayers, and allegedly Barack Hussein Obama, Barry Sotero, and Michelle LaVaughn Robinson could embed themselves inside the bureaucracy and be monitored and determined whether or not there was a risk of exposure.
Mm-hmm.
And then they could steer the documentation that would or risk their exposure and move it away from the legitimate judges and move it towards the corrupt courts so that these people could stay embedded.
Yes.
And so that would be logical then that Christine Marcy, Field's sister, who had a very senior position, we can talk about that a little later, but she was at the time of Waco number four at the Department of Justice.
Mm-hmm.
She would have been in a position to steer this documentation through and past the right and the wrong people in the Department of Justice and basically keep the terrorists out of jail.
Yes.
Now, so we got Bernadine Dorn joining Sidley Austin in 1984. We've got Barry Sotero trading around with the communist groups and cells in India and Pakistan. He made a visit to Hyderabad, I understand. And in 1984, someone commits a major act of sabotage on a company, Union Carbide, that would appear to have bought directors and officers liability insurance from a network that includes Sidley Austin as a law firm. At the same time, Sidley Austin had arranged to buy insurance against the event happening. Now, you can see what happens if the spread is sufficiently great. It becomes very interesting for Sidley Austin to hire saboteurs and blow the plant up.
Yes.
Now, right? This because
Yeah, I was going to ask. This event caused a number of deaths, didn't it, in the thousands?
8,000, I reckon.
8,000.
It's the biggest industrial disaster ever. And, of course, the media, including NBC, and so on, immediately jump onto it as a demonstration, this is big, bad, evil capitalism, etc. But Union Carbide called in the engineering consultancy, Arthur D. Little, and the Indian police. They all went out there. Arthur D. Little, the Indian police, and the technical team of Union Carbide all agreed that this was not possible to happen as an accident because the safety systems had to have been switched off, and someone had run a pipe pumping the water into the chemical.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sabotage.
Yes.
Now, so from 1984 to 1988, Union Carbide hired a law firm to defend it against the civil and criminal lawsuits, and the costs of that law firm were met by this insurance, which is rather like a tonti, and that law firm was Sidley Austin.
Mm-hmm.
Now, go ahead.
I just had a question pop up in my thinking, listening to this, and you're mentioning the Weather Underground. Have you been able to establish any possible connection between the Symbionese Liberation Army, the group out of San Francisco that supposedly kidnapped Patty Hearst, Randolph Hearst's daughter?
What I would say, that, and the answer to that is I haven't looked at that, but what is very interesting is the financial mechanism for hiring the killers is such that it doesn't matter which mercenary group they hire to do the killing, and it's futile to chase the mercenary group that's been hired simply because they can hire another one tomorrow and say, well, this is a different group, it's just the proof that everyone hates America. What I think forensically what we have to do is to look at the hiring mechanism. And what's absolutely fascinating is what Bernadine Dorn was doing in Chicago. She was training interns for Sidley Austin in this killing technique. This hedge fund, you know, the selling of the directors and officers' liability insurance at the same time as reinsuring against the event to make the money, to finance the growth of the revolution.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1988, she hired, Bernadine Dorn hired, Michelle LaVaughn Robinson. And the first two clients that were given to Michelle LaVaughn Robinson, who was taken on as an intellectual property lawyer, was Union Carbide and AT&T.
Mm.
So what happened then is Michelle LaVaughn Robinson went with a team of workers from Sidley Austin in Chicago to Washington, D.C. to work out the liabilities of Union Carbide in respect of the Bhopal disaster. Mm-hmm. And also to do one other thing, which was transfer the Clipper encryption chip from AT&T to corrupt elements inside the Department of Justice.
Now,
do you remember the name Randall Tobias?
Randall Tobias. No, I haven't.
He was the vice president of AT&T, or perhaps the president of AT&T International, and he was caught by the DC madam Jean Palfrey.
Okay, I remember that.
Jean Palfrey committed suicide.
So they say.
But I think that when Michelle LaVaughne Robinson was in Washington, D.C., she was instructing Jean Palfrey as to which characters should be basically seduced and entrapped and extorted by Jean Palfrey's stable of women.
Mm-hmm.
So they got Randall Tobias, the president of AT&T, and what he did is he handed over the Clipper encryption chip that allowed all communications between the CIA and the FBI to be monitored by this powerful internal group with the encryption keys.
I see.
And the other person that was caught in the sex sting by Jean Palfrey was a guy called Ullman, who was the specialist in the Pentagon on shock and awe.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have is Michelle LaVaughne Robinson, who in 1991 would marry what I think is a card-carrying communist called Barry Switero. But by then, Barry Switero had all his records reorganized, right? So this name, Barack Hussein Obama, emerged. His passport and everything else was recreated. His records at the universities were readjusted. So basically, they created a character. You could say it's like Barry the alien president or presidential candidate, a bit like a character in fiction called Barney the Purple Dinosaur. Now,
yes.
Do you remember Barney the Purple Dinosaur?
Well, I didn't follow him, but I have a pet that likes that show.
Okay, well, do you know which intellectual property was responsible for bringing this fictional character into the world? It was Michelle LaVaughne Robinson.
Was that from a nightmare, or?
No, this is the reality. So what Michelle LaVaughne Robinson was doing from 1988 to 1991, having been taught by the most dangerous woman in America, was how to create a fictional character, take care of the trademarking and the branding and the merchandising, etc. And it would appear to me that by the end of that period, by 1991, she could create a fictional terrorist group, such as Al-Qaeda, run it out through the media, and basically have everyone thinking that this was the real McCoy.
Yes. Now, David, I'm going to try to bring Field into the call here.
Oh, excellent. Okay.
So, you still with me?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, we had a fluky thing happen here, so I'm going to try one more time to bring Field in. It's not going to work that way. It keeps disconnecting us. I think Seth is going to try for us now. So,
okay.
Or Don or whoever's there. I'm told Seth might be away from the board at the moment. We'll just be patient. Field answered twice. So,
okay.
The problem is the listening audience didn't get to hear it, and neither did you.
Okay.
Field. He'll be joining us shortly. I don't mean to interrupt or disrupt your monologue here. You know.
Yeah, sorry. It's anyway, should I continue?
Yes, by all means, do. And
okay.
I think Seth will be having him join us. So there.
Okay,
he is.
So
I'm
let's
here.
let's let's say that the Bhopal catastrophe was a sabotage. It was an insurance or tontine hedge where the individual directors and officers of Union Carbide risked being taken to court, sued either for civil damages or criminal damages, and the media was feeding the public at large that this was due to capitalist negligence, if you get my drift.
Yes.
But it what was they did is...
I was going to say it was convenient for them to get there and film this event, right?
Exactly. So the snuff films is a very big element of this. And let me just go backwards to the Charlie Manson killing of Sharon Tate.
Okay.
What absolutely blew my mind after doing some reading was that prior to the killing of Sharon Tate, Charlie Manson and his friends had stolen an NBC TV truck with three Super 8 cameras.
Hmm.
And they found the blood, according to the witnesses who did the killing, they said they only did the killing inside the house, but they found the blood on the outside of the house. And I think what that means is that Charles Manson had brought the NBC TV truck to the scene of the crime to record a snuff movie.
And maybe they actually brought the bodies out to be filmed?
Yes. And then they took the whatever the recording medium was to Burbank, shipped it off to the 30 Rockefeller Center in New York, where David Rockefeller, back in the 30s, or 40s, whenever that, had put together a combined operation between NBC Studios, the CIA, and MI6 during the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
So what was happening during the Second World War, there were crews going around the world with embedded assassins and saboteurs in them.
I see.
And the way to get an insurance policy, of course, paid off was one of the best proofs that you've killed someone is to come back with the films of them being killed.
And then they use those films later on just as a collage of propaganda and so-called news that they had
gathered. And it triggers the life insurance policy payment, you see.
Yes.
So well, when... Sorry?
I was just going to say, I've had Vincent Bugliosi, who was the prosecuting attorney in that case, on this show, and I've known him since about 1987, 1988.
Right.
I met him personally back then, and of course he recalled that event, and that was one of the cases we had discussed. He had never mentioned that, and I may bring that up, or if you ever would like to speak to him about that, I
sure.
think it would be interesting. He's
sure.
very, very knowledgeable on the case.
Right. You see, what's intriguing now is with the extortion between the Weatherman, which I think is a union with a network which is still in existence, and Sidley Austin, they can go after a media like CNN or NBC or CBC and say, look, your directors and officers might be charged with criminal or civil negligence or criminal manslaughter if you send a journalist to an area that you know is unsafe and they're killed.
Mm-hmm.
So what they can do is they can sell Sidley Austin the directors and officers' liability insurance to the directors and officers of NBC, simultaneously with buying insurance on the journalists who are sent to the dangerous area.
Mm-hmm.
Then they decapitate them on the television, right? They
yeah.
come back and they threaten to sue the directors and officers of NBC, and at the same time, they've collected insurance from the poor guy who got whacked.
Yes. Now,
and that is a modern tontine.
Yeah, there's a recurring theme that is mirrored in this Buffalo plane crash that we've discussed.
Exactly.
At some point.
Exactly. Now, the Buffalo plane crash, I believe, was a Bombardier Dash aircraft, and Bombardier's directors and officers' liability insurance, if, for example, Bombardier gets sued because the autopilot has an attack of what I call autopilotus, and flies into the ground and kills everyone on board, the law firm that handles the directors and officers' liability insurance for Bombardier is Sidley Austin.
Yes. Now, I don't know if you recall this, if this actually occurred between your last visit on the show and tonight.
Right.
But through some serious research, I came upon a Mr. Stephen Wallace, a former police officer from Buffalo, New York, who works now as an EMS technician. And he went to the scene, filmed a huge pit underneath the airplane.
I remember you mentioned it.
Okay, so I did share that with you. He has come forward to testify that he interviewed seven witnesses at the scene who all described the plane being engulfed in flames as it came down.
Yes, well, we now know what incendiary they're using because Bombardier is in a partnership with the big French weapons supplier to Saddam Hussein. It's called Thales. And Bombardier and Thales transferred the patent technology provided them by Hillary Clinton when she was a patent lawyer at Rose Law in Little Rock, Arkansas, and probably the patent lawyers at Sidley Austin in Chicago. They've transferred a number of very important military technologies to the French or the French-speaking world. Mm-hmm. One is the triaxial gyroscope system, which allows you to fly a plane as though it were a missile remotely, mm-hmm. right? And secondly is the smacksonic insulation, which actually is rocket fuel or viscoelastic material that when ignited raises the temperature to 5,800 degrees Fahrenheit, which is half the temperature of the sun.
Yes.
So what the Tontine insurance scam being run by Sidley Austin involves is equipping these planes with the triaxial gyroscope and the flight box and the incendiaries, telling the directors and officers of Bombardier that it would be a good idea for them to buy directors and officers liability insurance because the plane might actually crash into the ground, and at the same time buy insurance on the passengers before they crash.
Mm-hmm. Now, we have Field with us, and I want to give him an opportunity not to cut you off. I do want
to revisit
this topic and maybe incorporate in Field into this conversation. Field, welcome to Evident Footprints. Glad we could get a hold of you finally.
Yeah, I'm sorry we had technical difficulty, but I just want to jump right in with what David was saying. I think the three biggest weapons on these modified airplanes tend to be the Boeing uninterruptible autopilot, slave to the QRS-11 gyroscopes, which are also called gyro chips, and smacksonic insulation. And I would encourage not only you, Don, but your listeners to Google those three groups of words, Boeing uninterruptible autopilot, plus QRS plus Maxonic, and you'll see that there's only five hits on the entire internet, and David and I are the authors of four of them. So it's not like this is really common knowledge yet, which is sort of frustrating because we've got a lawsuit out there that makes this very common knowledge, and we have a Federal Investigative Bureau and CIA and DOJ. These people have all been advised in writing. And, you know, it makes one wonder what you have to do to get people who've taken an oath to uphold their oath and do their job. And I'm sure you haven't discussed this yet. At least I don't think so. I had some technical problems at my end, so I wasn't listening to all of it. But there's a gentleman named Walter Francis Fitzgerald who just filed a criminal complaint of some nature against Mr. Obama, claiming that, you know, he's not entitled to be president, blah, blah, blah. This is old hat, and there's a lot of that going on. But this man's somewhat different. He's a Naval Academy graduate from the class of 75, and I just yesterday volunteered to join him in that complaint, so we'll see if that generates anything. But in answer to my own question about why the investigative branches, the Congress and the Senate, sit there and do nothing regarding the crimes of 9/11 and these ongoing aircraft crimes, which are, in some cases, they appear to silence people. I say that in reference to Buffalo with Mrs. Eckert, who is the 9/11 whistleblower, her husband. Yeah, and also, you probably haven't touched on this, but Paul Wellstone's airplane that crashed in 2002 in Hibbing, the interesting thing about that is there were three similar airplanes lined up on that approach, and two out of three of them got in. The one in the middle, which was Wellstone's, was taken out somehow. Right behind him was a similar airplane with Norman Coleman in there going up to a political event of some nature, and they all three flew through the same weather, the same meteorological conditions, and two out of three of them got in, but one of them didn't. And I just think there's way too many airplanes suffering mysterious ends when they happen to have politically expendable people on board.
Yes.
And now going back to Buffalo, Don, I don't think David's aware of this, but Don, did you hear any, have you heard anything that indicates that there was a big bright blue flash right before that crash?
I heard that from one of the witnesses that actually was interviewed on a TV broadcast, which was posted on a YouTube video. I didn't see the broadcast on television per se. It seemed to me like it was either an MSNBC or a Fox News video. Now the initial broadcasts, when I sort of picked up intuitively something was going on, and my listening audience is a witness to this fact. I was interviewing Ken Adachi, and I said I've just been impulsed to turn on my TV set. Of course, the volume is down because we're doing a radio show, but I began writing the names of the witnesses down, and I immediately began researching them and found synchronicities of a variety of anomalies in each of their so-called or proclaimed addresses by the media. It was published that they lived in Clarence Center, but it showed they were living in Buffalo. All the documentation I could find. Their claims in later releases of the same video, where I paid attention to what they were saying and listened to the audio, was in conflict with what Google Earth maps show the proximity of their so-called location from the crash site. There was, in every case, there was a discrepancy. If they said they lived two blocks away, they lived three blocks away. If they said, as one woman who was a so-called witness, said she lives between a quarter and a half a mile away. Well, normally people say, I live a quarter of a mile away. I don't live between a quarter of a mile and a half a mile away. What is that? Is that a third of a mile? In fact, it's 600 yards, okay, specifically, because I measured it. So I could say that just looking on my computer screen, and these people all had anomalous addresses in Akron, Ohio, and Buffalo, New York, although they all claimed to live in Clarence Center. And this is contained in the same databases. In other words, I've discovered how these people are being cataloged in these databases, and I can lead you and David to them.
Well, you might have stumbled there, Don, on something very interesting, and I didn't know if Field was listening to this, but we'd mentioned the Promise software that was developed in the 70s, and it struck me that Christine, you know, your sister, would have been in all the right positions to take on. Now, whether she did it knowingly or otherwise, the Promise software essentially allows you to build a database of suspects that you want to be concealed from the authorities, the FBI or the CIA or the Department of Justice, and shepherd them right through, we think, to the White House. Simply because you can make sure that they don't come before the kind of judge that would send them, put them on death row.
Yes.
So it's an incredible facility. And let me just, if I may, can I just jump to, because Field mentioned this woman, Beverly Eckert,
yes,
who was the wife of a man called Rooney, who was the vice president of risk management for Aon Corporation at the top of the South Tower on 9/11.
Yes.
He died.
Yes.
Now, this is beyond fascinating, and I only just discovered this document, this report, I think the day before yesterday. But it turns out that Sidley Austin was selling directors and officers' liability insurance to Aon Corporation at the top of the South Tower to, for example, protect those directors and officers if they failed to give an evacuation order during a major disaster such that a significant number of their colleagues were killed
mm-hmm.
in the attack, and they had to face legal action, either for criminal or civil action. So it was Sidley Austin that sold them directors and officers liability insurance. But Sidley Austin did something else as well. When the order was given, theoretically, to evacuate that building, we understand that the order was jammed and the people were actually told to stay in the building, Don.
Yes.
And after the attack, it turns out that Sidley Austin arranged for the payment of the people under a business travel insurance claim. And incredibly, what Sidley Austin said in their claim against Lloyd's underwriters was the moment the order was given to evacuate that building, the people who stayed in the building came under the Sidley Austin business travel insurance. So they filed a claim for $100 million on Lloyd's in London to compensate for the fact that the people who died at the top of the South Tower were actually traveling, even though they were stuck in the building because Sidley Austin had jammed the communication system.
Hmm. Now, you're describing similar people to those that were passengers on this Flight 3407.
It's the same process. What Sidley Austin is doing to Bombardier, which is the manufacturer of that Dash aircraft that crashed in Buffalo, is saying you buy the directors and officers liability insurance to protect yourself from a lawsuit. At the same time, they arrange that the avionics of the plane are modified by Bombardier and Thales with the QRS-11 gyroscopes and the encryption systems to backdoor the flight box so it can be flown into the ground, and then the evidence of murder for hire and insurance fraud vaporized with the smacksonic insulation. And
yes,
that's exactly what happened on 911.
Yes. Now, I examined the list. In fact, AOL had published a list. And I'm not supposed to talk about this according to their disclosure that this cannot be broadcast, but it's been put out on the Internet, so why not? I'm on the Internet, too. Aside from Beverly Eckert, Alison DeForge, who was the expert on the Rwandan massacre,
right,
and two musicians with Chuck Mangione's group, a teacher and I think an artist that was on his way to college, the rest of the individuals were all bank directors, officers of chemical companies, pharmaceutical companies, investment companies, along those lines. So they were all people of a high...
high-value targets.
Yeah, economic stature, we'll say. Yes, absolutely.
Yes, and high-value targets for revolutionary communists who want to intimidate directors and officers of major corporations like Union Carbide by threatening either... they pay the protection money, which is the directors and officers liability insurance, or they get whacked and they collect the money through life insurance claim in Lloyd's in London.
Yes. Now to go back to what Field had asked me about this blue flash, and I mentioned these other people because there was a lot of disinformation coming out, and these people were promoting the ruse that the plane had suffered from ice buildup on the wings. And the other planes in the area did not have that problem. And I found that the people that were the witnesses who appeared on television were singing the same story, and the media jumped on the bandwagon and promoted that. This was strictly orchestrated, as was the lawsuit that was filed in California on behalf of the school teacher that from the Buffalo area that died in this crash, supposedly being instigated by her surviving sons. Now, there was also a crash within the past week. I think it was in Montana. It was a flight coming from California, and it had made several stops, pickups and drop-offs on the way, 500 feet from the runway. What are the odds of that happening, Field?
Well, I'm not sure. This is real spooky. The airplane you're talking about was a Pilatus, I believe is how you pronounce it. It's made in Europe. But that airplane was overloaded, for starters, at least from a legal standpoint. It had more people on it than it was qualified to or certified. They're certified for so many people. This one had more people than that, which is neither here nor there. I've flown airplanes with too many people also, and they don't. That alone will not cause it to crash. It's just one thing you can point at when things go bad. But from what little I know about that incident, it sounded to me like the pilot had changed from one destination to another for whatever reason. One good reason could be for weather at the previous destination. Another reason might be lack of fuel to get to the destination, so you make a last-minute decision to go into Butte, Montana, where I believe was the intended landing. Mm-hmm. But eyewitnesses to that event, right before the airplane nosed over and went into the ground, the eyewitnesses said the airplane was doing a lot of turning, like he was performing at an air show. And from a pilot perspective, I think what he would have been doing, it's called S-turns. And when you're on final, and when you're on final approach and you're too high to get in safely, airplanes do S-turns. And there's many of your listeners, and maybe yourself, Don, who've been on airliners that do a series of mild turns on final jets. And what you're trying to do is by turning, you're increasing the distance to fly to the ground in terms of time and mileage both, and you're allowing the airplane to come down to the proper glide path. And I, mm-hmm. from the way this airplane in Montana crashed, which was it did a wing over, basically, they talk about, you know, it rolled over and went in nose first. Well, that could be caused by a pilot who's doing aggressive S-turns, because when you're turning the airplane and you're slow, you're setting the airplane up to stall, and when a straight wing airplane like that one was, when a straight wing airplane stalls, one wing will drop and one wing will rise, and when it does that at low airspeed, you have to be very lucky or very good to get it out, because you're dealing at low altitude and you don't have time. It sounded like the airplane was trying to correct, but the guy, I think basically that was pilot error, was what I'm saying. And I hate to say pilot error, because pilot error is what the official causes typically end up being when you have a dead pilot, because it's just more expedient, it's quicker, more efficient. Another case of pilot error recently was over in Amsterdam, where the Turkish 737 did the same thing on short final. At, you know, several miles from the airport, the thing flew into the ground. For no apparent reason. In that case, I believe the two altimeters were set at different settings, and that could have been partial cause. But and that was a very highly experienced captain on that Turkish airliner. But a lot of these things are quite odd, and your choice of words in talking about this, Don, you just mentioned something about icing on the dash aircraft, the Colgan Buffalo 3407.
Yes.
Had ice, whereas the preceding and following airplanes didn't have ice. And so while you were saying that, I wrote a note to myself called differential ice, meaning ice is affecting only a targeted aircraft, and that goes right back to Wellstone's incident, because you had three similar... David, are you there?
The line went dead. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, sorry about that.
Okay.
Yeah,
Go ahead, Don.
Yeah, Don, this differential ice, which is a term I just coined during this show, that's what took out Wellstone, too. And you might remember that Wellstone was a very, very vocal critic of the war in Iraq prior to the war in Iraq starting. And so, you know, that his official objection to the war in Iraq, of course, died when he died. And I think it's quite odd that the airplane directly in front of him was also a beach aircraft, a Queen Air operated by Babenji Airlines, and it got in without incident and without ice. And the one right behind it was a Beach King Air, which was the same thing that Wellstone was flying, a Beach King Air. And the Beach King Air had no ice and no problem getting in. And the way I know this is because I just happened to be sitting next to the guy who was the captain of the Beach King Air that hauled Norm Coleman in right behind Wellstone. And we sat together on a flight from Minneapolis to Detroit on my way back here to Kazakhstan. And when, you know, this is the stuff that has not ever hit the media, not that I'm aware of, and I live in Minnesota. I hope it hits.
Yeah.
Well, it certainly should hit. It's hit way too late. I certainly don't want to put myself in a position of that sounding like I think I know something or I know everything, but, you know, the day of the Wellstone crash, I was at home in Minnesota. The day after the Wellstone crash, I was in the Minneapolis airport talking to the Minneapolis chief pilot who'd been up to the crash site with an NTSB guy on the day it happened. And he mentioned some things that were not in accordance with what we were hearing in the media. And I just think, even though the Wellstone incident is 7 years ago, and some people would say, well, that's old news, and why waste time trying to figure out the truth of the Wellstone incident? Well, I think it's not old news. It's the same pattern they go back to time after time. And when I say time after time, there was a lady who had some relationship to the Watergate scandal that died in one of the very first of these mysterious plane crashes, and that, off the top of my head, was United 554 at Midway Airport. They silenced mm-hmm. a woman. But they do this all the time. And I'm not suggesting that every single crash of an aircraft is designed by these people that like to make insurance money on dead people that need to be quiet. Like the Pilatus that crashed in Montana, my personal feeling there is when they get done investigating that, they're going to find they had a pilot who made some poor choices in terms of loading the airplane and doing some S-turns. But that, once again, I don't know. But I've flown airplanes for a long time, and I haven't crashed one yet. So I believe that when David has concluded that a lot of these airplane incidents are insurance and money-making events, I think he's absolutely spot on. And that brings us right back to 9/11. You know, if we could just solve the flying events of 9/11, the other crimes, we could fill the prisons with some very high-profile names. Don, I also want to, you mentioned the gentleman and two men in California that were responding to the Colgan thing because their mother died, and how you thought it was odd that a bunch of the eyewitnesses gave sort of convoluted testimony. And David might want to talk to you now about an organization called VNN as opposed to CNN, which VNN is Virtual News Network.
Yeah, I'd like to come to that in a moment. I wanted to make two quick points before I forget to make them. You were talking about differential ice. Now, the witnesses, one of the witnesses in Buffalo is a 12-year-old girl who swears that the plane was on fire and would not know what icing on a plane was all about. She wouldn't have the knowledge mm-hmm. of that, but certainly could recognize fire or flames when she saw it. The other point regarding these types of crashes, whether it's differential ice or whatever excuse they come up with, in the case of pilot error or differential ice, it should not result in a bullet hole in the back of the head of one of the passengers, such as a former Department of Commerce Secretary Ron Brown during the Clinton administration. Is that correct? My deduction would be correct.
And just to pick up on that, Don, if you remember the Travelgate scandal where they went after Hillary, this would be consistent when the Clintons tried to privatize the travel agency inside the White House with their friends in Arkansas. What it appears to me is that during the 90s, they were setting up this hedge travel arrangement where simultaneously they could identify high-value targets like Ron Brown, make sure that there was a pool of people in the travel office, the Air Force, who would subscribe to one of these Tontine arrangements or director and operator liability, and then at the same time buy insurance on the people who were traveling in the plane so that they would have a huge spread between the money they would bring in through the insurance claims and the money they would pay out in defending the people against a lawsuit, if you get my drift. Yeah. So the idea of Travelgate, where the Clintons effectively privatized the travel arrangements made for high-value targets who might blow the whistle on their schemings, because the Clintons transferred huge amounts of highly confidential material to the communist Chinese through the Department of Commerce with their cronies, and after Ron Brown was killed, that position was taken over by William Bailey, who is a colleague of the First Lady of the United States at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs.
Mm-hmm.
So it is consistent with this theory that I think may go back to the period when Sidney Austin was working with David Rockefeller on the estate of the daughter of John D. Rockefeller, Edith Rockefeller. Apparently, Sidney Austin worked from 1931 to 1951. That was the period when the Rockefeller Plaza included the NBC studios, and Phil mentioned about the virtual news network. What
yes.
we think that they've done from perhaps as long ago as the 1940s or before the war is create the ability to transmit a virtual news story over the mainstream media. Right? So it looks like, you know, the Georgians are attacking the Russians, or that Saddam Hussein is all-powerful, or any kind of fictitious thing, or the war game of 911, where there was a woman with, announcing that the building number 7 had come down when you could see it over her left-hand shoulder.
Yes. Yes,
right?
Exactly.
It didn't come, came down 20 minutes later.
Yeah.
Well,
now, building number 7 is
24
minutes,
actually.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's
good,
fascinating.
Good.
Yeah. Going back to Sidney Austin, it would appear that Sidney Austin had arranged for the directors and officers of businesses inside World Trade Center Building Number 7 to buy liability insurance that would protect them against lawsuits if they failed to issue an order to evacuate the building before it was demolished. Right? Simultaneously, Sidney Austin, through it on behalf of its clients, Equitable Life and so on, had bought life insurance on the people who might be killed if they didn't get out in time.
Yes.
It's an extraordinary, I would call it Satan's hedge, you know, because they win both ways.
Yeah,
the interesting thing, of course, they established total control by fear, which is why the anti-racketeering statute was introduced.
Mm-hmm.
There is no director, and I was a chairman and director of my own little company in the UK. How can a director discharge his or her duties to the shareholders of the corporation when they know if they don't pay protection money to these clowns, the next plane that they get on might be a one-way trip?
Yes, and then you have the actual removal of all the debris in a very hurried-up fashion to
which is done by Acorn.
Yes, and it doesn't permit any sincere, honest, above-board investigation of the facts. You would
think that's consistent with the Promise software shepherding the real suspects past the investigators. And again, I can't prove that Christine Marcy or the chain of command or the chain of custody of Promise, but it would seem to me that whoever got hold of the Promise software in the 70s and then took it through the 80s when Bernardine Dorn was working at Sidney Austin basically facilitated the transition of the Weathermen terrorist underground movement to an embedded network that has now got its command center in the White House.
Well, I would venture to make a very educated guess based upon my research that would have been the Cook County Courts in Chicago, Illinois. And
right.
that they are also using that to launder the stolen assets of criminally impoverished litigants in the Justice Department's court proceedings at all levels. We're talking about every particular venue of the court system, be it domestic relations, child protective services, probate,
right.
real estate, whatever. And that is documented by one of the former members of the Sicado crime family in Phoenix, Arizona.
Right.
So you've heard me speak about this before, and it is the Promise software. They actually have several back doors into the Maricopa County Recorder's Office computer database, which has been cleaned up by a military contractor somewhere up in the state of Minnesota as of July 4th, weekend 2007.
Right.
I know that specifically.
Right. And you see, those residential mortgage-backed securities and commercial mortgage-backed securities that were pumped into the ghetto with no hope of recovery. That's a classic Marxist technique, is to lend money to people who can't pay it back, and ultimately you could then squeeze them with concessions, including murder for hire. So Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae were basically, they were organized in 1968 at the same time as the Small Business Administration 8A program. They were loan engines generating loans to people who couldn't pay them back. And the law firm that pioneered residential mortgage-backed securities and commercial mortgage-backed securities in the 70s was Sidley Austin.
So then they have to be... Oh, I'm sorry, I was going to interject that they would have to be then the ones who have masterminded the asset-backed securities trust pools, which fall, they have actually a designation, number 2006-HES, and then the mortgage pass-through certificate, series 2006-FES. Those
right.
are the vehicles they're using to transfer these properties from the actual mortgage paper, the original contracts, to banks all over the world through securities which are being sold as derivatives and hedge funds.
Yeah, and the people who put together the Resolution Trust Corporation to tidy up the savings and loans, that was done by Sidley Austin. And Sidley Austin was also advising John McCain of the Keating Five how to stay out of jail. So you can see, going back to 1868, fast forward to 1906 when these scams were banned in the United States, they go international, they team up with the Royal Bank of Canada, the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank, and the French bank BNP Paribas. They come back into the United States. They create these pools of tontines or debt, which is then lent on, and then basically they pay the various groups of saboteurs and assassins to kill the members of the tontine until there's a sole survivor who picks or cleans up the pot. And in the case of Sidley Austin, it turns out the sole survivor is not Barack Hussein Obama, it's Michelle LaVaughan Robinson.
Now, there's a synchronistic date that you brought up on past shows, and you brought it up twice this evening, David, and that's 1906. That happens
right.
to be the date that they proclaim that John, and this is another synchronicity, John Sidney McCain Sr. graduated from the Naval Academy in Annapolis. Yet
right.
there is no, despite his becoming an admiral, in the Navy, posthumously, they say, after his return to Coronado, California, upon the Japanese surrender and the signing ceremony, he mysteriously died within a day or so of his return. And I found his arrival in the United States around that time and actually up until about 1924. He was traveling on merchant ships under the name John McCann. And that this character, John Sidney McCain Sr., Jr., the grandfather and the father, so-called father or alleged father, were actually offspring of King Edward VII when he was known as Prince Albert Edward. And that their birthplace was actually Glasgow, Scotland. And they were sailing on ships owned by Teddy Roosevelt at the time, part of the United States line, and which was probably the king's, or it would have been the queen at the time. It would have been the queen's ship, but it was a merchant marine ship, and they infused him into the U.S. Navy. He'd never went to the Naval Academy. In fact, his picture reveals a man 20 years older than his proclaimed age of 60 when he took a picture on a ship deck with Admiral Halsey. They were of the same age, and yet he looked 20 years older. Well, he was 20 years older because he was born in 1865, not in the late 1890s, as they proclaimed.
It's fascinating about the McCains, because if you look at McCain in the Hanoi Hilton, that would be a classic opportunity for the formation of a tontine. You know, the prisoners who cooperated survived, right? The sole survivor gets the freedom and the girls and the day pass to go into town and basically have cookies with visiting Cuban dignitaries and that sort of thing. The other guys get whacked and tortured.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and the insurance on them is then paid into a pool, so when McCain comes home, and remember his nickname was John Songbird McCain, because he was basically telling the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong the best ways of outmaneuvering the Americans. His wife at the time has a terrible accident, right, so he marries an heiress who's connected with the Bronfman and the bootlegging fortune. And I think he was a naval liaison officer for the Senate in the Pentagon. An incredible position, when you think about it, for designing the low-level bombing attack that took out the U.S. Naval Command Center on 9/11. And I would suggest that it would be worth looking at the insurance taken out by AMIC, which is a British Montreal-based company that incredibly had the upgrade contract for the U.S. Naval Command Center of the Pentagon and would appear to have bought directors and officers liability insurance for that building to cover, for example, a failure to evacuate the building during a war game that resulted in the death of 120 people, including Captain Gerald Oconto. So you can see the hedge. The hedge kicks in in every crime scene on 9/11.
Couldn't the wet start of McCain's that caused the accident, I can't recall the name of the ship, but I know he was...
Forrestal.
Yeah. There we have an assassinated former Secretary of Defense who supposedly committed suicide by jumping out a 15th-story window from Bethesda Naval Hospital. And then you have a wet start on a carrier that resulted in numerous deaths, many more than were reported in the Wikipedia explanation of McCain's heroic act. And then I say that sarcastically. And simultaneously, in the year he was shot down, which I recall as having been 1967, we had the attack on the USS Liberty. And coincidentally, who is heading that investigation? His father.
Right.
Who was made the commander of the Atlantic Fleet at that time and head of that investigation, which likely was another tontine.
You see, what David Rockefeller did when he employed or deployed Sidley Austin to work on the estate of Edith Rockefeller that was in dispute, over those 20 years, it would look like Sidley Austin, which by 1940 had 60 years of experience in putting these tontines together for families, such that from one generation to the next, the money would move without exposure to taxation, and the brothers or the relatives would always have an internal motive to control each other, because if they got it wrong, then one relative would be killed, right, and the assets would be then transferred to the survivors. So at the moment, the patriarch of the Rockefeller Empire is David Rockefeller, but I imagine they've already identified which one of the various children and grandchildren that they want to take on that role, and whoever takes on that role controls, let's say, for example, the Rockefeller Plaza. In the Rockefeller Plaza, you have the NBC studios, and at any time... particularly by sending the occasional anthrax-laden letter, you have enough fear amongst the NBC officers and directors that they do exactly what they're told in terms of transmitting propaganda, including the decapitation of one of their reporters or the provision of a NBC TV truck to record a snuff film at the house where Sharon Tate was. Such that material can be transmitted. What we think now is, Field and I have been working on this for some months, is that the snuff movies that record the death of a target and are used to trigger the insurance claim are now all transmitted on it by encryption over a network built by a company up here in British Columbia called McDonald Detmeyer and Associates, which does three things essential to carry out a Tontine attack. It builds the what's called the Tontine algorithm, which means that you can have a network provided by Cisco, for example, the world's largest provider of routers and switchgear and so on. Within that network, where they've built a virtual pentagon, you can have a small group of conspirators that are equipped with the Tontine algorithm where they can develop the maneuvers without the knowledge or consent of the innocent participants in the war game, if you get my drift.
Yes.
The second piece of software that McDonald Detweiler develops out of the reach of the racketeering influence corrupt organization is what's called guidance and control systems, which can work through the autopilots of ships or boats or trains, if you will, or planes, combined with what's called ground moving target indicator. So if you look at that, we know that the cameras of the brothers, what's the name? The Noday brothers,
yes.
Yeah, if you look at the imaginary crosshairs of the cameras, they were pointing at the point of impact before the thing impacted.
Yes.
And the odds against that happening are millions or billions to one, unless you've fed the cameraman and the missile with the coordinates of the point of impact.
Yes, I agree wholeheartedly. Jump in.
Yeah, I want to jump in there because you guys are both absolutely correct. But what they did, it appears, is they had a laser target designator slaved to the camera. And what I mean, it's just like a scope on top of a rifle. You've got a scope that's parallel to the rifle barrel. Same thing with this camera. So the cameraman was actually identifying the target. In other words, by having a laser target designator slaved to his camera, the cameraman knew which window at the World Trade Center, you know, to target. So he put his camera right there, and when he put his camera right there, prior to the aircraft even being in the field of view of the camera, by the way, it was a couple seconds later, by placing his camera viewfinder on the target, it also placed a laser target designator light beam on the target, and the QRS-11 gyro chips in the drones could home on that, because that's what QRS-11s do. They're part of a Maverick missile, which I believe is an AGM-65, a Raytheon-produced Maverick missile, which homes on a laser target designator, and it's called a laser-guided, you know, missile.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really discouraging to us that years after this happened, and, you know, we've told the FBI, and we're very graphic, and that brings us back to Colgan and Buffalo and the blue flash, because I believe that could have been a direct energy weapon, which would then explain why the 12-year-old girl saw the airplane engulfed in flames, because if it was fuel, which, you know, is always a possibility, you could have a fuel fire, well, it wouldn't engulf the airplane in flames. The flames from a fuel fire are trailed directly behind the source of the ignition. In other words, if it's an engine on fire, all the flames will be directly behind the engine. If it's a fuel tank that's ruptured, all the flames would be directly behind the ruptured fuel tank. You don't have an entire airplane on fire unless it's been lit up electronically by some direct energy weapon.
Mm-hmm.
That's my two cents worth, because the airflow would remove the flames if they were fuel sourced.
Yeah. Now, the
blue flash might be an ignition flash field.
Well,
that's
there
what
are...
I think it...
Yeah, there's a couple of anomalies, and I'm going to point out something if I can. In regard to the Noday Brothers film and this miraculous capture of this event, there were, and we may have discussed this on a past show, I think I may have done this a couple of weeks ago when I appeared as sort of a last-minute guest with David on Dr. Christopher Holmes' show right here on BBS Radio. And that whole event in that intersection, speaking about the gas leak and the calling of the fire department. See, the Noday brothers weren't supposed to be there filming all of this stuff on 9/11. According to the official story, they were documenting the future career of a wannabe fireman. And this fireman stayed at the firehouse the entire time all of this was going on and didn't even appear at the site of the gas leak, the so-called gas leak. Well, there was no gas leak. And there was an individual that walked across the intersection wearing a blue shirt. This can be seen in the No Day Brothers film. And he makes a sort of a motion. It's very subtle motion, but it was a signal for that camera to be aimed up at the building at that time. Simultaneously, the sound of something that did not sound anything like a jet passes overhead. And it would have been extremely loud passing over those tall buildings. A taxi horn can be heard 100 stories up and louder than you can imagine. The sound is extremely amplified. And conversely, the sound of a jet airplane flying over skyscrapers would be deafening. And yet it was a very obscured, strange, unnatural sound. It didn't sound anything like a jet airplane. You would hear the whining of the engines, and you know what I'm talking about. Anyone that's ever seen or heard an airplane, a jet pass overhead, has experienced that sound. And it's extremely loud when you're anywhere in the physical proximity of it, especially if you're standing amongst skyscrapers. So there was a lot of doctoring of that film, and doctoring of the shooting of the building, we'll say. The plane looked very surreal, what we see in the video. These guys, actually, I've traced them to Venezuela. They're not French at all. I've traced the whole family and the relatives, and they all come from Venezuela, which is interesting in and of itself.
Well, yeah, and that would be consistent with the network built by Bernadine Dorn. You see, in 1969, she went to Cuba, and Pierre Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada, sent about three or four members of the FLQ, the Front de Libération de Québec, and they created a terrorist training school in Cuba that, for all I know, it's still there.
Mm-hmm.
1972, it would appear these people organized the Munich Massacre, the Olympics. And again,
yeah.
You know, you've always got the killers and you've got the cameras.
Yeah.
And the cameras somehow know where they need to be to catch the killing. And of course, that's the mechanism. Now it's done through the internet where the footage is actually transmitted through a secure encryption system. Just coming back to the last piece of software developed by McDonald Detweiler, what McDonald Detweiler will then do is, as soon as there is hard evidence that the target is dead, so maybe the people at the Buffalo crash amongst them were a group of witnesses who merely wanted to authenticate the fact that the people were killed, particularly Beverly Eckert,
yes.
Because she was one of the holdouts against the compensation for the death of her husband, Rooney, you see. So what McDonald Detweiler does is then automatically attaches a lien, which is presumably the equivalent of the reinsurance claim, to the property of the victim. So when building number 7 came down, it was discovered subsequently that the insurance on the mortgage of that building, the mortgage being $400 million, sometime between October 2000 and September the 11th, someone had the smarts to double the insurance policy on the mortgage to $800
million. Hmm.
Right?
Yeah, and
so with the Twin Towers, Travelers Insurance, which was the subsidiary or partner of Citicorp after Robert Rubin had put that deal together, they had arranged that the insurance pool, which I think was a Tontine pool, for the Twin Towers, did not declare what the exact terms of a double occurrence would be, so it defaulted to New York law. In New York law, they were able to claim a double occurrence, i.e. two separate terrorist acts, would you believe, that allowed them to collect an extra $1.3 billion.
Yeah,
and you can buy an awful lot of assassins and saboteurs and No Day Brothers and so on for $1.2 billion.
Yeah, and then they had the gold heist, which occurred in the lower levels of the World Trade Center, and the insurance implications there, as well as the put options on the airlines and all of that information.
And they were short in Chicago. You see, the Dow Jones Industrial Average started to go down on the 6th of September on 9/11, and it went down 25%. You know, that's a huge amount of money, right,
yes.
If you're short in Chicago. Now, very interestingly, on the 17th of September, 2001 at an office called the AXA Gallery, 787, is it 7th Avenue Field? You know all these things.
That's in Washington, D.C., isn't it?
Oh, anyway, the AXA Gallery in New York, they opened an emergency payment center, Don, to hand checks out basically go-away money for the Beverly Eckerts of the world for the death of the people who'd been insured. But in that office, which is the AXA Gallery Equitable Life, is the New York headquarters office of Sidley Austin. So Sidley Austin arranged the hedge insurance for 911 on the Twin Towers and building number 7.
Yeah. Well, gentlemen, we're out of time. I did want to address the issue of this energy weapon, because there is documentation. If you have a chance, look at the film called September Clues. It analyzes what appears to be a missile coming down at an angle at one of the towers, as well as a slow motion analysis of a ball of energy that's moving in a similar direction about the same time. I'm told that that is an antimatter weapon being used, okay? And I've felt this intuitively all along, that that is a result of the burned cars blocks away from where this disaster was initiated, and that it would be a matter of the energy distribution in a very disorganized fashion as this energy moved down toward the ground. The towers themselves acting sort of as an antenna. If you visualize a lightning bolt hitting an antenna and a ground wire being attached to that antenna, it's going to cause that energy to move down to the ground. Well, there's a similar reaction when you aim this near the top of a building, it will move downward, and when it hits the ground, it spreads out in a symmetrical pattern, but not a constant or not a complete coverage, if you get my meaning. And so yes, you may have two cars adjacent to each other burned to a crisp and the car in front of them or behind them without a scratch. That is the nature of such a weapon. And it can be seen in the September Clues video. I urge you to look at that. In closing, I guess I could throw one final question. This question actually came into me via the chat message 20 minutes into the show, David, before Field joined us. And the question was from one of our callers, so we have all this information, how do we get to the tipping point? And I guess that's a roundabout way of saying, how do we affect justice here? How do we bring this to some area of responsibility and culpability?
Yeah, I would say, Don, if I may answer that. Well, we have our website at CaptainSherlock.com. Perhaps we could just get a plug in there, where there's a huge amount of material.
Yeah.
But the challenge for yourself and Field and myself ultimately is to simplify the explanation without trivializing it, so an average person can grasp what it is. You know, and I go back to how they got Al Capone. They got him on tax evasion. So if we can ultimately strip out all the stuff about the politics, the Marxists, the communists, and so on, it was an insurance fraud. And if we can demonstrate how this hedge insurance fraud or tontine works, where they force the directors of a target company to pay protection money, which is what it is, if they fail to pay the protection money, they whack them, and they collect the money from the insurance on the victims or their property.
Yeah.
That's a pretty simple, to me, that seems a pretty simple model, particularly when it goes back to 1868.
Yes, absolutely. And the timelines, you know, that timeline coincides again within a space of 3 years of the visit of Prince Albert Edward to the United States to set up the phony McCain lineage.
Right, and then if you look at the Armenian genocide of 1916 or 17, and then the Holocaust, in which George Soros was an active participant, it looks like they were paying the Armenian Catholics to kill each other, the Jews to kill each other, like Soros basically arranged it, in order to be the sole survivor and collect them from a Tontine pool. And if you go through the records, you'll find that Equitable Life has been sued by the survivors or the descendants of the Armenian Catholics massacred in 1917 and the Jews massacred during the Holocaust. So Equitable Life's law firm that puts the Tontine together is Sidley Austin, which employed the First Lady of the United States from 1988 to 1991, where her clients were Union Carbide and AT&T.
Yeah.
So we've got the woman, and again, this is from a fiction or a story or a drama point of view. Again, people can visit Captain Sherlock. We've got the woman at the center of the beast inside the White House. And she's undefended because, of course, Barack Obama can defend himself because he's got all the organs, but his flank is undefended, if you will.
Yes, and we're talking about a woman that wore a Black Widow spider dress on the night of the exception speech.
She's the Lady Macbeth.
Yes. Well, gentlemen, we're out of time. I'd like to have you back again if you would both come back. This has been very energetic and very revealing. Field?
Yes.
Can we invite you back as well?
Yes, and I'll try to overcome any technical difficulties, although it is 12,500 miles, but I'd love to speak to you. I'll be back in the States in 2 weeks, and until then, anything from Kazakhstan I can do to support you, I'm more than happy to do so, Don.
Okay, well, we'll be scheduling you in within the next couple of days, so when we know we can get you both on together, I think it would be very enlightening for our listening audience. And I want to thank both of you gentlemen for the work you're doing, and encourage the listening audience to visit both hawkscafe.com, that's HAWKSCAFE.com, as well as Captain Sherlock, written out, CaptainSherlock.com. Don't put written out in there. That's not part of the address. Gentlemen, it's been an absolute pleasure. I want to thank you for the great work you're doing. And David, you are in Canada. You're not American. We can tell by your accent because it's not a Southern Alabama accent by any means.
No. And funnily enough, what we're going to find out is that British Columbia, where I am, and I'm the leader of a political party here, is absolutely pivotal to the attack of 911 because we had the technology, we did the staging and the logistics, we developed the software to steer the planes and to recover the debt and to use the encryption system. So the spotlight is inevitably going to be on this province up here in the west of North America.
Well, maybe we can delve into that on our next show.
Thank you very much, Senator.
Okay, thank you both for appearing on the show. I look forward to your next interview. Folks, you have been listening to Evident Footprints on BBS Radio and our special guests, David Hawkins and Field McConnell, and they will be back on another show. Special thanks to Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, Seth Hendrick on the sound, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in, as well as our mystery caller with the mystery question. I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light. Join us again tomorrow. In the meantime, have a good night.